From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, what to do when an epidemic becomes a matter of national security. We talk with Dr. Peter Piot, the executive director of UNAIDS, the United Nations agency coordinating the fight against AIDS. We'll also discuss how war spreads the illness and how governments and religious leaders sometimes stand in the way of measures that can help prevent AIDS. Dr. Piot saw his first AIDS case in 1979. He also co-discovered the Ebola virus. We'll talk about what those diseases looked like before they even had a name. Also, world music critic Milo Miles reviews CDs by two contemporary soul singers, Alicia Keys and Babyface. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. President Bush says the anthrax incidents and the September 11th attacks on the U.S., whether linked or not, were all designed to destroy the nation's economy and way of life. Mr. Bush says the U.S. is up to the challenge. NPR's Pam Fessler has more.
During a visit to a printing and packaging company near Baltimore, President Bush said the economy should not become another victim of the September 11th attacks.
We fight in a war on two fronts. We fight a war at home. And part of the war we fight is to make sure that our economy continues to grow.
He called on Congress to enact a tax cut bill that would include breaks for business investment and rebates for low and moderate income workers who were unable to benefit from earlier tax cuts. The president wants a package smaller than the $100 billion House bill and hopes the legislation will be modified in the Senate. Democrats say more should be done to help laid-off workers instead. Pam Fessler, NPR News, The White House.
Pentagon officials say the Taliban rulers of Afghanistan may be planning to poison relief shipments of food from the U.S. and blame it on the United States. Rear Admiral John Stuffelbeam says the military has gotten word of such a possible scheme.
Those who have control of those foodstuffs that are not reputable is one way to put it, I guess. For instance, the Taliban, who we know have control of some Red Cross warehouses of foodstuffs, or Taliban who may be collecting the humanitarian daily rations that are dropped. If it comes from that source, I would be very suspect.
Stuffelbeam called the Taliban and al-Qaeda terrorists tough warriors, and he said he's been surprised at how doggedly they're clinging to power. Secretary of State Colin Powell says he hopes the former king of Afghanistan will be able to rally the disparate political and tribal groups together to form a post-Taliban government. NPR's Michelle Kellerman has that story.
Powell told the House International Relations Committee that the Taliban must go. He says Afghan groups are starting to meet in Pakistan and in Turkey, and he's hoping a post-war government can start to gel soon. Powell added Pakistan, which helped bring the Taliban to power, understands it can't play the dominant role.
Pakistan cannot do it the way it did it before. It has to be an internationally blessed process, and it has to involve the UN. And it has to involve all of the Afghan people, not just who they might favor at a particular moment to put into power in Kabul.
He said he'd like to see the United Nations play a leading role by offering administrative help to any new Afghan government. A UN special envoy, who has sounded more cautious, is preparing to visit countries surrounding Afghanistan. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 5 points to close at 9,345 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq did even better, up 27 points today. This is NPR News. The federal government has reached an agreement with the maker of the antibiotic Cipro, which is in high demand as an anti-anthrax drug. The Bayer Corporation will sell the government 100 million of the pills by year's end for $95 million. That's about half the regular price. The Postmaster General says there are no guarantees right now that the mail people receive is safe. John Potter added that health experts believe the chances of contracting anthrax through the mail are very slim, but he advises Americans to be cautious in handling the mail and to wash their hands afterward. Authorities say a man arrested by the FBI in its investigation of the terrorist attacks has died of natural causes in his jail cell. Doug Doyle of member station WBGO has the story.
The 55-year-old Pakistani native whose identity has not been released died Tuesday morning at the Hudson County Jail in Kearney. The New Jersey Division of Criminal Justice says the autopsy performed today in Newark by the state medical examiner showed the man died of natural causes. The man, who never had charges filed against him, was found by guards at the jail. He was arrested September 19th as part of a probe into terrorist attacks, but was being detained on immigration charges. The FBI had cleared the man of any terrorist activities or links to terrorist groups. Authorities say they won't release his identity until they notify his wife in Pakistan. For NPR News, I'm Doug Doyle in Newark.
The U.S. is considering asking the U.N. Security Council to criticize Israel's offensive in the West Bank. For the past year, the U.S. has blocked or vetoed any Security Council action on the Middle East conflict, but Israel has been rebuffing the White House request to withdraw its forces from Palestinian-controlled territory. U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan is also insisting on a pullout of the Israeli forces. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM, the nature of what's to come, at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dr. Peter Piot, has observed how countries around the world deal with epidemics. And he's come up against the political, social, and sexual denial of many political and religious leaders, which prevents them from effectively dealing with the spread of disease. Dr. Piot is executive director of UNAIDS, the United Nations agency coordinating the fight against AIDS. He also co-discovered the Ebola virus, which we'll talk about later. Dr. Piot is a physician and microbiologist who grew up in Belgium. Earlier today, he went to a studio in Geneva, and we recorded this conversation. I'd like to ask you briefly first what it's like to have dealt with the AIDS epidemic for so many years, now watching terrorists use anthrax to attack Americans. I mean, after all the time you've spent trying to stop an epidemic, here are terrorists trying to create one. What goes through your mind when you see that?
Well, first, the September 11th events and the terrorist attacks on New York and Washington are something that was certainly a major blow to the international interest in AIDS. And the way I look at it now is that first we've got to, we need a world without terror, that's for sure. And at the same time, we've got to take care of those issues that are major factors of instability in the world, and AIDS is one of them. It's one of the top issues for the 21st century, there's no doubt about it. For me, they're fairly unrelated issues, AIDS and bioterrorism, in the sense that we've got to fight both, but HIV is something that is, in essence, not so easy to transmit. It's not a virus that would be very interesting from a perspective of a bioterrorist, at least that's what we can say. But on the other hand, it's spreading at an incredible pace throughout the world, continuously.
You've said that AIDS is causing a lot of instability in the world. What's the connection between AIDS and political instability?
Well, in January 2000, nearly 2 years ago, the UN Security Council, then chaired by Vice President Gore, held a debate for the first time on AIDS as a security issue. And it was both a breakthrough in the concept, how we look at AIDS, but also in how we look at security, where traditionally security is seen as the absence of conflict, of armed conflict, and of deadly threats. Now the concept is that security is more than that. It's the absence of fear, absence of hunger, absence of fatal epidemics, such as AIDS is. And AIDS is definitely a factor of instability. Suffice to look at, particularly at the worst affected countries. I'm thinking here in the first place of southern Africa, where we have countries where 30 to 40% of the adult population is infected. In other words, one out of three people, nearly one out of two adults. And what are the implications of that? First, that these people will die prematurely, to say the least. And that's particularly the case in poor countries where modern treatment is not available for a variety of reasons, mostly economic ones. And secondly, AIDS doesn't only affect the poor, it also affects the skilled, the well-educated, for example, in several countries, a country like Zambia in Central Africa, today there are as many teachers who die from AIDS as the country trains every year. So that's a disaster. We see the same thing in businesses, managers, engineers, doctors, nurses, agricultural workers. They're all dying from AIDS. And so that means that the countries are destabilized because they're driven more into poverty. And then we've got the orphans, those who are left behind. For every adult dying from AIDS, there are certainly in societies where they have many children, like in Africa, there are many children left behind, orphans. Who's going to educate them? Who's going to feed them? They often become street children. Their potential reserves for warlords, put them a Kalashnikov in their hands, and, you know, they have no future. We have also the fact that many of the armies in Africa are very, very heavily infected with HIV, well over 50%. Much of that information is confidential, but it's available. And so that means also that defense systems are collapsing. And so all that is illustrating the same point. AIDS is a factor of instability in the world today.
You mentioned that in some countries, 50% of the army is infected
yes.
with AIDS. I'm wondering if you worry about AIDS every time a new war breaks out, even in this current war with terrorism, do you worry that that's going to just further spread AIDS? Because after all, in any war, you have different populations coming together, bleeding a lot.
Yeah, first, historically, we know that wars have been major conduits for the spread of classic sexually transmitted diseases, be it syphilis in Europe in the 16th and 17th century, gonorrhea during World War II or the Korea War, the Vietnam War. So that's one thing, and that has to do with the fact that war is associated with violence. Violence often includes also sexual violence, and this is what we've seen throughout the world, that women get raped and that they're often, in addition to being raped, are also being infected with HIV. We've seen that during the genocide in Rwanda a few years ago. There is less social control. You have the military with a uniform, with some money and with arms. There are displaced populations, sometimes millions on the run, refugee camps, people, particularly women, having only their body to sell in order to survive, to feed their kids. You know, all that means that every time, indeed, there is an armed conflict and there are lots of refugees, I think, oh, here we have it again. This is going to increase the spread of HIV. We've seen that in Sierra Leone, in Liberia, in West Africa. We've seen it in Rwanda, in eastern Congo. So that has been a historic fact, and it's unlikely that that will change.
How much of an issue is HIV in Afghanistan, for instance, or in Islamic countries near Afghanistan, where the social code is really quite strict and quite conservative sexually?
In general, one can say that in the Middle East, going up to Islamic countries such as Pakistan, that up to now, HIV has been a very small problem. It's not that it's not there. About Afghanistan, we have hardly any information. But in Pakistan, we know that HIV is there, particularly in injecting drug use populations, but not so much in the areas near Pakistan, but in the major cities like Karachi. Iran also has a growing injecting drug use problem. And we know that in prisons, there are quite a few people with HIV. But there's no comparison with what we're seeing in other parts of Asia or in certainly not in Africa. Central Asia also, with countries like Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, it's growing, but still very low, low levels. Conflict will undoubtedly have a potential for more transmission through sexual contact, be it, as I mentioned, violent sexual contact, rape, or also commercial sex, which is often accompanying armed conflicts, even in very traditional Islamic societies that exists. And then we're also in the middle of the area in the world of production of opium and heroin. And one question that I have is that whereas people are using heroin through sniffing, smoking, and opium, are they going to switch to injecting the drugs, which is a phenomenon we're seeing slowly happening in a country like Pakistan? And that, from an AIDS perspective, is also disastrous. But in general, one could say safely that in the Middle East, in most of the Islamic countries there, that HIV has been much less of a problem than in the rest of the world.
And do you think that's because of the very conservative social and sexual code?
Well, there's far stricter social control. Contacts between men and women are more difficult, between men as well, sexual contacts. On the other hand, it is there, HIV, and it may be that it's more of a matter of the pace of spread, and that it's going to go much slower, just as we've seen in most of Asian countries, that the spread of HIV has been much slower than in Africa. But at the end of the day, we may get to the same type of levels of infection. It's just slower. It just takes longer. We have to look at this epidemic in terms of decades, not in terms of the quarterly report.
My guest is Dr. Peter Piot, Executive Director of the United Nations Agency, UNAIDS. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Peter Piot. He's the executive director of UNAIDS, the UN agency coordinating the fight against AIDS. What stage of the epidemic would you say we're in now? Where are we?
From a historic perspective, meaning taking the long-term view, we're definitely only in the beginning of the epidemic. And why am I saying that? In the beginning, because we are still seeing an increase in the spread of HIV wherever there are no effective programs. We've seen decline of new infections in a country like Thailand, in Cambodia recently, in Uganda, in Brazil, in most of the Western countries, although there it's quite stable now because of failure, I would say, of prevention programs. But everywhere in the world, every year, we have the sad job to announce that there are more people are infected, that the rate of increase in the spread of HIV has gone up, and that is typical for a beginning epidemic. And as I said before, we've got to look at this in terms of decades. Even in Africa, even in countries where 30% are infected, we still see an increase in the number of infections. But there, fortunately, prevention programs are being put in place. But when I look at Asia, when I look at Eastern Europe, then it's clear that we're at a very early stage of the epidemic. And by the way, Eastern Europe is the part of the world where HIV is spreading fastest at the moment.
One of the things you're up against is that AIDS awareness means talking openly about sex, heterosexual sex, homosexual sex, and it also means empowering women to have some control over their sex lives, insisting, for instance, that a man use a condom or having some kind of sexual protection. And apparently not all countries support this. For instance, over the summer, there was a UN meeting in which a declaration of commitment to combat AIDS was drawn up. And one of the clauses in this was to be about protecting the human rights and fundamental freedoms of groups who are at risk, and that included homosexuals. What kind of opposition did you get to that?
There is no way we can tackle AIDS and the AIDS epidemic without talking about sex, and we can't dance around the issue. It's impossible. And I was actually, in a sense, happy that during these debates of the special session of the General Assembly at the UN in June, that homosexuality, women's rights, women's control over their sexuality, sex education, that all that was discussed in rather non-diplomatic terms. My major fear was that, as is sometimes the case in international bodies, that some incomprehensible diplomatic language would have covered up all this. No, we went to the heart of the discussion, and that's a real problem for us. I would say that the two main issues that we have to deal with when fighting AIDS is the denial that it exists and that it has to do with sex, and on the other hand, the stigma associated with HIV, which is also to do with the fact that it's mostly transmitted through sex or is associated with drug use, with drug abuse. And this is not only an issue for some backwards countries, for Islamic countries, this is an issue in about every single country I have been at, and is also a problem in Western countries. How many of the Western countries have advertisements on AIDS and how to prevent it and being explicit, or on condom use on TV on prime time, not after midnight, prime time? My children went to school in France, and they didn't get any sex education at school except for the biology of reproduction, which is a totally different matter. Sex education has to do with relations, how to make sure that boys and girls are empowered to go through life and have a responsible sex life, but also looking at sex as an integral part of the human condition and of life. So we have a real problem. That's what AIDS reveals.
Now, one of the issues for AIDS prevention is the use of condoms. Mm. Has the Pope and the Catholic Church been an obstacle for you on that?
Yeah, the condom issue is one of the more difficult ones in our daily work. And it is still true that the Catholic Church objects to the use of condoms. When we look at what happens in practice, it's a bit different. First, our position in UNAIDS is the following one, and that is that when it comes to preventing sexual transmission of HIV, we have ABC, and by that I mean A for abstinence, B for be faithful, and C for condom. It's easy to explain. The Catholic Church says AB, and we complete the alphabet to go to ABC. And what I'm asking the Church is not to object actively against the promotion of condoms and to stick to the scientific facts. And for example, not to say that condoms would promote the spread of HIV, what some clergy have said. Now, on the other hand, I know that from our daily work in the field, be it in Africa, be it in Latin America, in Brazil, or in Asia, that Catholic nuns and priests, that in health centers, for example, that they're managing, that condoms are available. I'll never forget an encounter I had with a Catholic nun in Ivory Coast in West Africa, and she was in charge of a big program of health services, but also dealing with orphans because of AIDS. And she showed me the education material they had for the community, and so, one of those flip charts, and then suddenly I saw a condom on there, and I said, Mother Superior, you are promoting condoms. And she said, when I show this, I show this as a woman and not as a nun, because people are dying here. So she had decided for herself what is the best. But it remains a problem. And whereas in Uganda, for example, we have a Catholic bishop who is the chairman of the National AIDS Commission, and which openly promotes condoms in a big way, and that's part of the success they had in Uganda. in the neighboring country, in Kenya, the church is quite opposed actively against the promotion of condoms and is now in conflict even with President Moi about it. So I think there is much less of a monolithic position of the church than one would think. And we are working very actively, not only with the Catholic Church. We have even an agreement and a memorandum of understanding, as we call it, with Caritas International, the big church, Catholic NGO, but also with other faith-based organizations, with Islamic groups. UNAIDS has produced a video and a booklet on the role of imams in the fight against AIDS with quotes from the Quran and so on. I can't quote them, but that was made with imams so that they can use that in their community because they're influencing the lives of so many people, although it's limited in their impact because otherwise we wouldn't have an AIDS epidemic.
Well, what is? I'm sure it's your inclination to respect the religions of the world. Mm. At the same time, sometimes religion is an obstacle for you because it's the religion that stands in the way of sex education and of the dissemination of condoms and education about condoms. So what can you talk a little bit more about your strategy in dealing with religion when you sometimes, you know, run into a religion that's an obstacle to your cause, an obstacle to stopping AIDS?
It is a fact that we need to have the religious groups on our side. And so rather than to be confrontational, what we're trying to do is to look for common ground and to see where they can contribute and what we can do. So our strategy is, to answer your question, is to identify the common ground. I'm asking that they're not opposing condom promotion, and they have an increasing role also in treatment and care of people with HIV. Now, all that doesn't mean it's a rosy picture. We have daily problems, but we've made enormous progress.
Dr. Peter Piot is the executive director of UNAIDS. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Audi, presenting Audi-assured certified pre-owned cars, including the A4, A6, and A8 with quattro all-wheel drive. AudiUSA.com/pre-owned. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Living Terrors, What America Needs to Know to Survive the Coming Bioterrorist Catastrophe, by Dr. Michael Osterholm and John Schwartz. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Dr. Peter Piot tells us how he co-discovered the Ebola virus. And we talk more about his work as executive director of UNAIDS, the United Nations agency coordinating the fight against AIDS. And Myla Miles reviews new CDs by two contemporary soul singers, Alicia Keys and Babyface. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dr. Peter Piot, the executive director of UNAIDS, the United Nations agency that is coordinating the fight against AIDS. He also co-discovered the Ebola virus. Dr. Piot is a physician and microbiologist who grew up in Belgium. Our interview was recorded earlier today. When and where did you first see AIDS?
The first man with AIDS I saw was actually in 1979, but I didn't know it was AIDS. It was a Greek fisherman who was working in what was then called Zaire, now the Democratic Republic of Congo, and who'd come to Belgium for medical care and had died from unknown causes. And we had kept his blood and his other specimens from his body, and later on we could demonstrate it was AIDS. But I really got basically full-time involved in it in 1983 when I went to Kinshasa, the capital of Democratic Republic of Congo, to investigate whether AIDS was a problem there, because we were seeing an increasing number of AIDS patients in Belgium. And what was so interesting then in these days is that were not only men but also women, and in these days it was thought to be a homosexual disease, which, by the way, I never understood why a virus would care about the sexual preference of its host. And also, I was thinking, if we see, let's say, 10 people with AIDS coming from Congo, from Central Africa, that means there must be thousands there, because who can afford to come to Europe for medical care? And that's, since then, that's I've been working full-time on AIDS, yeah. That has changed my life.
Why have you stayed with the AIDS epidemic for so long? Some people burn out after a while because it's so devastating to watch the spread of the epidemic. Mm. You've stuck with it for years.
I think there are several factors. First, I was mainly involved in research, and then I moved into what I would call at the moment more of the politics. My ambition is more of a political nature now, in the sense that to make sure that AIDS is at the top of every country's agenda in the world, and that and the money is there. So it's because probably I've dealt with various aspects, from the virus to the people to the politics. And secondly, I think in general I'm someone who's more of a, let's say, a marathon runner than a sprinter. So I guess we get less easily burned out. Take it on one step at a time.
Have you ever been worried about contracting AIDS yourself, because you have worked with people with AIDS for so long? Have you ever had any close calls in which you thought you were infected?
Well, I've had an HIV test, but also there was one incident certainly in 83 in Kinshasa, where I had a needle injury after I had collected blood from a woman with AIDS, and we even isolated the virus from that blood, so there's no doubt it was in there. And so then I was really worried, but there was no test at that time. In the HIV diagnostic test only became available in 85. So that was, that was really worrisome. Yeah.
What's the most devastating example of AIDS you've seen in your travels around the world?
I think the most moving experiences were, let me mention two. One is in Rwanda, you know, a country where 1 million people were killed in a genocide several years ago. And I met with a group of women who were survivors of the genocide and who were HIV positive and who had been raped during the genocide, and who their rapists had left alive as even a worse punishment, if you want, or than if they would have been killed. And that was absolutely just, I couldn't imagine how people could behave like that. And they were without treatment. It's the same story in most developing countries. People with HIV have no treatment. They lose everything. And another experience where I felt really, particularly being a man, I felt really ashamed was when I walked through an area in Bombay in India where you have a lot of prostitution with very young girls coming from Tibet, from Nepal, from other parts of India, basically locked up. And I wondered also, I mean, how can humankind do something like that? I mean, families selling their daughters, of course, because they're poor, but this whole sex trade and trade in girls and women, and where 50-60% are HIV positive. That's, that was really not only shocking, but on the other hand, this is keeps me going also. It's certainly a boost for motivation for the work, which is very often frustrating.
Maybe you can choose a country for us that you think has been doing an effective job in stopping the spread of AIDS and give us a brief description of what they've done that's been so helpful.
There are now a growing number of countries that have less infections today than they had 5 years ago, and that's our goal, to stop that. Let me take one country that has done particularly well, and that's Uganda. Uganda is in eastern Africa, and in the early 90s, there were over 20% of the adult population in the country was HIV positive. Today, that's something around 8%, still very high by any standard, but a major drop. And what's the secret there? Well, there's no secret. Hard work, leadership. The president, Museveni, took it on as a national cause and imposed on all his cabinet, on all leaders in the country, to talk constantly about AIDS, to take this on in their work, whether they're in charge of a business, of a church, or of the Ministry of Health. And secondly, far more openness about AIDS. Thirdly, people with HIV got themselves organized so that they developed support groups. Major investment in sex education for young people, in condom promotion, and it has resulted in a later age of first sexual intercourse, less sex partners in the population, and far more condom use. The problem now is to make sure that the people who are already infected, that they have access to treatment and care, and because that's not the case yet in Uganda.
My guest is Dr. Peter Piot, the executive director of UNAIDS, the United Nations agency coordinating the fight against AIDS. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Dr. Peter Piot is my guest. He is the executive director of UNAIDS, the United Nations agency coordinating the fight against AIDS. You co-discovered the Ebola virus. When and where did you first see Ebola?
The first known Ebola epidemic occurred in 1976 in what was then called Zaire, and I was then working as a young physician in training for virology in Antwerp at the Institute of Tropical Medicine, where we had received specimens from a Belgian nun working in then Zaire. And that was my first contact. And after we had isolated the virus, we shut down the laboratory immediately because we were not equipped for this high-risk type of viruses, as the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta are, for example. And together with them, I went then to Zaire and stayed there for 3 months to investigate the epidemic, and so many patients with Ebola, all of them died, collected specimens and lived among them for 3 months.
It seems to me that Ebola must be a particularly horrible disease to witness, because toward the end of the illness, you bleed from every orifice, and it just must be horrifying to see that.
Yeah, if in Ebola virus infection, basically what happens is that 1 week after the infection that you got into contact with the virus through blood or you know, other body fluids, you start getting ill, flu-like type of disease, and then a week later you're dead. And as you say, by bleeding from your ears, your gums, eyes, intestines, and so on. And it's a horrible sight. And in 76, we had absolutely no clue how Ebola virus was transmitted. Were this mosquito bites, water food, shaking hands, blood or sex, you know, all the classic ways of transmitting viruses. But today we know that it's through contact with blood and with other body fluids, and it's not so easily transmissible. And every Ebola epidemic we've had had died out spontaneously. So
why does it die out spontaneously?
What happened classically is that people with Ebola virus admitted to a hospital will infect others, either in the first place the medical staff, doctors and nurses, particularly when they don't respect hospital hygiene precautions, which is often the case in developing countries. And then also there is transmission through injections when one doesn't use disposable needles. So just closing down the hospital makes that patients with Ebola have no opportunity to infect many people except for their closest relatives. But then it dies out. It's a virus which is probably not well adapted to human beings, but comes from some animal, we don't know which one, and it kills its host also immediately. It's a very badly adapted virus to people. HIV virus, that's the ideal relationship with the host, because you can have HIV and be healthy for 10 years, 15 years, transmit it, so the virus doesn't have to jump from one host to another, as is the case with Ebola.
So the rapid death of the person with Ebola is bad for the virus in the sense that the virus doesn't get an opportunity to spread.
These epidemics are of relatively short duration.
When you're a doctor studying an illness like Ebola, before you know much about the illness and before you really know how it's spread or how it's even caught, what do you do to protect yourself? I mean, you're not even sure exactly what you should be protecting against.
Yeah, that's a problem, but we know what the ways of transmission of infectious diseases are, and of viruses, and so you try to protect yourself from that, and it's making sure you don't cut yourself, no needle injuries and so on. You don't have any direct contact with, certainly not with body fluids, so you can wear gloves, masks, goggles, so you protect the potential entries of the body. But the problem is that if it's mosquitoes, there's nothing you can do. If you don't know it, except for repellents, but you can't completely avoid that. So, you know, it is it's risky, and everybody who had been working there had certainly, we all shared our fears.
Wasn't there a part of you that wanted to go home and not be in the center of this disease?
Well, I was 27. I was quite adventurous, and the curiosity, the excitement of the discovery, and of doing something new was at that time that was stronger than my fears. The fear came afterwards, I must say.
When the fear did hit you, were you worried you might still come down with Ebola, or was it just the acknowledgement of the risk you had taken while you were there?
Yeah, more the risk had taken, and I had some fever. I mean, when you're 4 months or 3 months in the tropical rainforest in Africa, it's absolutely normal that you have diarrhea, you get some fever, you work very hard under extreme stress, and then you wonder, you know, is this it? Is this Ebola, or is this just a bit of a cold or a diarrhea because yesterday I ate something that was not well preserved and so on. So that's the kind of daily fear, but but as I said, it's the team that was there was just incredibly dedicated, and we didn't take stupid risks. These are calculated risks, but they remain risks.
Did your team name the illness?
Yes, we what we did was that a virus, of course, needs a name. And we didn't want to name it after the village where the first cases had appeared, Yambuku, because we had experience in the past that these villages got a very bad name and be stigmatized. So we looked for a river, which was not too far from it, and that's Ebola is the name of a river We only had a very small map of a very big country, and so it wasn't, after all, the closest river, but it's a nice name. It's a very poetic name, Ebola.
But now the river's stigmatized.
Yes. Yeah, but it's a river, in the tropical rainforest, hardly anybody will cross or come across.
Now, you know, in listening to the news all this time, in this atmosphere where anthrax has been sent through the mail and people are wondering what's next, I have heard people speculating, is it possible that Ebola can be weaponized? Is that possible?
Well, saying that it's impossible would be not scientifically correct, but I think it's unlikely because it's not easy to transmit. But in today's technical possibilities in terms of genetic engineering, nothing is impossible if you really work towards it. Ebola at the moment has always occurred in very isolated populations in close contact with forest, tropical rainforest, and so on. I don't think it would be a great candidate for bioterrorism, but again, you never know.
There's a story I would like you to tell, and this dates back to when you were in Zaire in the early days of Ebola. And it's a story of a helicopter ride that you decided not to take.
Huh. Yeah, when you're working in investigating a new epidemic like Ebola virus, and that's happening in a very remote area, like it was the case in 76, the virus may not be the major risk and the major danger. We, for example, we had to use helicopters to go to all kinds of villages because the alternative was going walking and would take days. What happened to me is that one day a helicopter from the president of the republic in Zaire, President Mobutu, came to pick me up to meet with a delegation of officials from the capital outside the epidemic zone. And the weather, it was the afternoon, the weather was getting bad, dark sky, thunderstorms. I felt that the pilots had a few beers, and I didn't like that either. And so I decided I'm not going to go in that helicopter. I also had another reason for not doing was, I said, if these people come from the capital, can't come to where the action is, where the epidemic is, well, why should I go to them? Unfortunately, what happened afterwards, unfortunately for the people in the helicopter, is that the helicopter crashed. That was one of the most important decisions of my life, but you don't know it. But the lesson for me is that life depends on just on nothing. And I think we're seeing that also with the current, with the terrorist attacks that have occurred, that in 1 second, 1 minute, you're dead. And you don't know that the decisions you take to take that plane or not to go on that helicopter, that they're a matter of life and death at that time.
Do you feel like you've become more of a fatalist over the years?
I'm not a fatalist in the sense that I let things go. I really try to have an impact on the course of events, and perhaps a bit too in a too ambitious way. Look at trying to fight AIDS and bring the AIDS epidemic under control. That's something that you can't be a fatalist if you do that. But certainly realize that life is limited and that one has to live every single day, and that it is important to think through what you do, that the decisions can have enormous implications.
Well, I wish you very good luck in your fight against the spread of AIDS. And I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Peter Piot is the executive director of UNAIDS, the United Nations agency coordinating the fight against AIDS. He spoke to us from Geneva. Coming up, Milo Miles reviews CDs by two contemporary soul singers, Alicia Keys and Babyface. This is Fresh Air. Yeah. As an old soul music fan, music critic Milo Miles was happy that the style has made a comeback in the last few years. But until he heard the latest albums from Alicia Keys and producer-performer Babyface, he feared he was looking for love in the wrong places.
I can't seem to get past the first date with the new generation of neo-soul singers. There's the all-pervasive problem with consistent songcraft. Toni Braxton and D'Angelo are good for only an isolated track or two. And then there's the ever-tricky business of balancing body, spirit, and heart. Someone who has trouble with this is Erykah Badu, who, to me, can sound both racy and ethereal, but not romantic. The most persistent problem, though, is that so many of the young singers are clearly more children of hip-hop than any old school of soul. But suddenly I'm overwhelmed by a newcomer, Alicia Keys, and a veteran professional, Babyface, not just because they've made sensuous records for all seasons, but because I can hear where they come from in the Soul Clan. When Alicia Keys performed her potent version of Donny Hathaway's Someday We'll All Be Free during the recent Tribute to Heroes telethon, I was especially sad that performers' names were not announced or displayed anywhere. But then she did have the number one album in the country at the time, Songs in A Minor. And one of the joys of my existence is a vivid, rewarding record that's also a hit. But Keys works in a style that's always had broad appeal. Back in the early 70s, us lowbrows called it prep school soul, typified by Roberta Flack and, yes, Donny Hathaway. This secular gospel flaunted its good taste and classy eclecticism. But Keys's classical training just enables her to integrate the Moonlight Sonata with a funky beat, and the blunt attitudes and rough language of hip-hop keep her from going too smooth. Her song, A Woman's Worth, is the killing me softly for our more gender-equal age.
You could buy me diamonds, you could buy me pearls, take me on a cruise around the world. Baby, you know I'm worth it. Dinner lit by candles, run my bubble bath, make love tenderly to last. Not just dough, but a show that you know she is worth your time. You will lose if you choose to refuse to put her first. She will and she can find a man who knows her worth. Cause a real man knows a real woman when he sees her.
Kenny Babyface Edmonds has been a professional musician about as long as Alicia Keys has been alive, so you'd expect him to have healthy soul roots. But beyond the predictable references to Stevie Wonder or Luther Vandross, you have to go back to his breakthrough group, The Deal. They were an 80s Los Angeles version of Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. And Babyface's album, Face to Face, suggests beat-aggressive late-period Robinson songs like Cruisin'. As they were with Smokey, remembering dance rhythms and pushing your voice a little have been a tonic for Babyface.
You so busy, worrying about all the things you can't do nothing about. Maybe it's time to change your route. Instead of plugging in so much, you should look out. You have so many things to smile. Like love.
Also like Smokey, Babyface has become an expert scene setter and a subtle psychologist. On Face to Face, he specializes in particularly adult romantic pangs, regret, and the memory of unrequited love. The highlights of the album are four She Should Have Been My Girl tunes that are as wistful and wrenching as any lonely grown-up could want.
Baby, baby,
Babyface and Alicia Keys may be most gripping right now because their albums don't dwell on squabbles, put-downs, and resentment between the sexes. Whether it's teenage passion or middle-aged ardor, the strong cuts deliver romance that's neither easy nor unbelievable. They offer love to lighten dark days.
Milo Miles lives in Cambridge. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Hall, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I keep on falling in and love. Sometimes I love you, sometimes you make me blue. Sometimes I feel good, at times I feel used. Loving you, darling, makes me so confused. I keep on falling in and out of love with you.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we celebrate the 40th anniversary of the film West Side Story, with two actors who won Oscars for their performances, George Takaris and Rita Moreno. And we talk with Marnie Nixon, who dubbed Natalie Wood's singing part. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.